tell me about the workshop you're going to be doing at Kazoo Books on June 25.
It's a workshop that I've offered in a number of different contexts, flash fiction workshop. And Gloria at Kazoo Books wanted to aim it towards youth, middle school and high school students, which is something I've done here in Grand Rapids at the Great Lakes Commonwealth of Letters. And it's really fun because a lot of these students are interested in writing stories, and they often want to write kind of odd stories, and they often write very short stories, even though they think they're writing novels. And but they often put qualities of novels into the very short stories. But I can do we do a number of exercises that kind of focus on the basic structure of a very short story, which is very similar to a paragraph, and do some kind of fun exercises with that.
And the workshop is called Flash Fiction Writing. Now, for those who aren't familiar with what flash fiction is, you've said short stories, but it goes a step beyond that. Can you explain what flash prose is?
Yeah, well, flash prose, it covers both fictional and non-fictional. And the problem is with using a term like that's become a common term for very short stories, like flash, what used to be called sudden fiction or microfiction, is many of the magazines that publish those things also publish prose poems, which are very similar, but not exactly. And then some of them have limits in terms of the number of words. So some of them say up to 300 words. I think nanofiction does 300 words, and somebody else says 500 words, and somebody else says 1,000 words, and so 800 words. You know, so the definition is within the number of words that whatever the magazine wants to do, but it has to be a complete piece. That's the thing. It has to be a complete story or a complete vignette if it's nonfiction and that kind of thing. In many instances, so it's not just a slice taken out of a longer story. It has to have a unity that has a place to start and a place to end within those limits, whatever the 500 words or 300 words, that kind of.
Now, you've mentioned something called the abrupt introduction in terms of flash fiction. Can you explain what that means?
In that instance, with this exercise in flash fiction, with keeping the stories very short, in the workshop, I remind people or review the basic qualities of a paragraph. Because many paragraphs are 100 words or a couple hundred words in essay writing. And the basic structure for a paragraph is, we have a topic sentence, and then everything follows the topic sentence. And so the topic sentence includes everything, you know, what the paragraph is about, and kind of where it's going and how it's going to end, all in that single sentence. So with flash fiction, we look at the same thing: how to get characterization, conflict, and, you know, direction and setting and point of view all into a single sentence. And once we do that, then that sentence guides kind of the length of the flash fiction.
Now, you yourself, you write in different genres. You have poetry, you have prose. Do you have a preference?
Depends on the day of the week. Recently, I've been doing more fiction for the past couple of years. I retired from Fair State University in 2013, and so I've had more time. And that's given me an opportunity to kind of explore the fiction more. But, you know, I was doing more all along. Always short. I don't do a lot of I don't write novels. I don't have an interest in that. But the fiction has been very short, which is why I'm happy that now people are interested in flash fiction.
Is there an increasing interest, in fact? I'm thinking that these days, especially young people, are so used to texting and Twitter and all of these short forms, and perhaps even have a short attention span. Is this the most suitable, perhaps, type of genre for young people today?
I think so. I think whether the kind of the short text things influenced, I think just came of age at the same time. But there has been, over the past 10 years or so, an increased interest in the very short fiction, and very short, with the, you know, they kind of parallel the development of media. So there is that kind of, but to say that it's a short attention span, for me, it's a little bit misleading, because while the thing that we produce, the short fiction or the poem or whatever that appears in the media, doesn't often involve a very short attention span, the production of that isn't necessarily the same. And I think that's one of the problems, is people think that they can just jot down any, you know, the first 500 words or any kind of thing, and it's because it's short, it's flash fiction, and that doesn't really work. You know, the smaller the poem, often the more time and energy it takes to get it to work in that particular form. The same thing is true with very short fiction. So,
oh, I think so. I think sometimes simplicity is the hardest to achieve.
Right, right. So the attention span on the person that's reading it is relatively brief, and you know, the person writing it then has to take that into account and try to get it so that it works in that brief brevity. And I think in a lot of ways people, you know, and there does seem to be quite an interest in that right now.
Let's take a step back here. Tell us something about your journey as a writer. Is that something you always knew you wanted to do? It was that something that went hand in hand with being in academia?
I trace my earliest interest in short stories way back to writing short fiction, back to like seventh grade or sixth grade when I was, we lived in a cottage. My dad had went on Platte Lake. He winterized it by, you know, putting plastic over the windows and putting a small gas heater in it. And that's what he called winterizing it. But we were pretty isolated. And for lack of anything else to do, I started, you know, I loved to read. My parents were both readers. Everybody in my family were, you know, we always had books around, went to the library. So it just seemed natural that I said, I can do this, you know. So I sat down one day and said I was going to write a novel. I told them to leave me alone. And then after, you know, hours and hours and hours of writing, I had my dad typed it up for me. It was like one page. But
I love it.
And, you know, because it was an assignment, I took it to school and kind of showed it to my English teacher. And she was so thrilled that, you know, somebody had written a story without having to be assigned, that, you know, she shared with all the other students. And so I had a good feeling about that was something I could do. And then came back on and off, you know, when we had to keep journals and stuff in middle school. And then in high school, in a big way, I got involved. I got interested in poetry. And
so what got you interested in poetry, Philip?
Well, that's another kind of odd story. It was, maybe it was boredom.
That's the second time you've said that, boredom. And I love that. I worry sometimes that our youngest generations get their schedules so filled with activity that we're not giving them time to get bored. And out of boredom comes creativity.
I think that's a very good point. Yeah, when you think about it, I think they fill their lives with that stuff because they think that they need to, and they don't really want to confront the, you know, the meditative or the contemplative or the creative side, which, you know, when we were kids, we made up stuff as we went. You know, it wasn't organized baseball, it was field ball, and we changed the rules as we needed to. And, you know, now all the kids are in, you know, organized sports. So I think there's some of that in there, but but I was introduced in, you know, it was my junior year in high school was a transitional year for me. I was not doing as well as what my mother and father hoped I was doing. And until we were introduced to, I had an English teacher introduced us to the Beat Poets. And that, in those days, it was Lawrence Ferlinghetti. And we didn't really get to Ginsberg because there was some question about whether that was appropriate for us. But you know, it was kind of goofy, wild poetry and wordplay. And I was really good at wordplay because my family was full of punners and teasers and stuff like that. But so we would make parodies of things. These other boys and I would make parodies of things and make jokes about what, you know, poems that you might want to write in the boys' lavatory as opposed to somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fun. It was, you know, people laughed, paid me some attention, and I happened to be pretty good at that wordplay. And so from there, I just started keeping notebooks and was jotting down stories and decided at the end of my junior year that was the direction I was going to take. So in my senior year, I loaded up with English classes. I took both the, you know, we were supposed to choose either composition or literature. I took both classes, and I was just, you know, I was producing writing on my own and decided that that's where I was going to go when I went to college.
And then we can go a little forward to your newest work that I've had the pleasure of reading. And for all this, it's a chapbook of gorgeous poetry that was written in a very special place up in the Upper Peninsula on Isle Royal. And I understand you were an artist in residence there. So take us to that place and take us to that experience. You, what, lived in a cabin there for a while, or how does that work?
Yeah, it was a great experience. The National Park Service actually offers a number of artists in residence. I was really interested in Isle Royal simply because I know people that have been there and everybody talked about how special it is. So the Park Service, or the Isle Royal Park Service, has a cabin that they provide, the Dassler family cabin, of one of the few cabins that they have maintained. In most instances, when it became a national park, you know, the people that were there had like lifetime leases and stuff, and then the cabins have all kind of disintegrated. The national park only maintains a certain, you know, a certain trail. And what's interesting is you asked me about fiction and poetry, and I had been writing almost fiction almost exclusively for a couple of years before that residency in August of 2014. But I had proposed because I thought poetry would be more amenable to not having, because we didn't have computer access or typewriters. You know, it was just my and an paper and me. I thought poetry might be better than to try to work out some stories up there. And so it was a little bit of a challenge because it was coming back to poetry. And so I was doing both poetry and a little bit of fiction, but and then I was doing printmaking as well. I do linoleum. So the print on the front of that book, in fact, is one of the prints that I did when I was up there.
Oh, I missed that. I really like it, too. It's very attractive. And how much did you feel a difference wherever you usually write, maybe in your office or you have a study or whatever? Does place influence your work? I mean, being in such a different, remote, wild place as Isle Royal, how did that affect your work?
You know, Isle Royal is really an incredibly special place, and very good writers have been up there. My friend Marianne Baruch was a resident up there, and Keith Taylor was a resident up there. Keith Taylor was one of the first, and they produced some very wonderful kind of work that I was familiar with. So that's the kind of an additional pressure to me to come in at the late date. And I felt in the poems that I didn't want to just simply write another poem about how beautiful that place and special that place was, because it is. I wanted to personalize it in a way that both brought the images out and made it my special place, as opposed to, and so in that respect, yes, the place does have play a large role in kind of the inception of what I'm working on. But the trick is, I think, both in poetry and fiction, and even nonfiction, is to capitalize on that environment that you're kind of absorbing and turn that into the environment that ends up on the page, which is, you know, unique in itself, you know.
I wonder if by any chance you might have that chapbook somewhere within reach and you could read a selection for us.
Particularly when you talked about flash fiction and kind of an example of flash fiction, an example of poetry, I would love to read one of the poems from and for all this. But I also have a little flash fiction piece that came from Isle Royal that does not appear in that book.
Yes, go for it.
So, yeah, this is from another series, a series I've been working on for several years, in which the character called Amateur Husbandry, in which the main character is actually married to or involved with a character called Yellow Horse. And then the encounters, there's a number of different encounters with different kind of animals. And this is one that stems from both that kind of series, this kind of strange, surreal environment of a person and dealing with animals, and it comes directly from the Isle Royale experience. So it's called What's Not to Like, and I'll try to read it so that you can catch the pun. There's a pun in here, which I hope you'll get, but What's Not to Like. I was packing a backcountry trail when a seagull blocked my way, perched on an aerosol can as if it were a wharf. "You look like the rustic type," he said, "all wool shirt and Timberlands. Have I got a deal for you?" "No, thanks," I said quickly. "I recognize the pitch. Everywhere the same. Urban, rural, wilderness." "Liking it," said the seagull, picking up and putting down his foot, one eye focused on mine. "I'm sorry," I said. "You will be," he said, "liking it." He's one foot up and down. "I could let you in on the ground floor if you don't mind the pun." "The pun?" I said. "Lichen in a can," he continued. "Just spray it on. Your woodwork will look natural in minutes." He gestured to the fructose, the tree's beard. "All natural," he repeated. "I make it myself." "Oh," I said, "lichen it. I get it. Clever. But no." I stepped around him. The gull was too far from shore to be convincing. This one is called Hairy Long-Tongued Dogs Upon the Bed. Hairy Long-Tongued Dogs Upon the Bed. And in Isle Royale, you know, as exploring the island, and they always, the park rangers give us introductions to the geography of the place, and Isle Royale is actually a chunk of rock that was pushed up as the ice during the Ice Age, when the ice was kind of going through and, you know, grinding out Lake Superior, so that the island all kind of tips at an angle, and they say that Marquette tips at the other, or the Copper Harbor, Copper Peninsula tips in the other direction. So these two, anyway, so you have to imagine that it's a big stone kind of at an angle. And this poem relates to that. Hairy long-tongued dogs upon the bed. If our house were an island of tolerable size, smaller than Isle Royale by far, yet situated similarly in a lake of superlatives, coldest, deepest, most unpredictable, and our bed were a private cove at the easternmost end, I'd lie on the north side, cliff sheer and treacherous, volcanic rock thrust steep against the harshest of pronouncements, the harshest gales, as dismissive of squalls as cynics of celebrity hem and yaw, so dead to the world, as they say, I'd worry the most stalwart of well-seasoned Great Lakes fishermen. And you, my love, would be the South, just as firm in many ways, basaltic, solid, and yet inclined to slope more gradually, to meet the lake halfway and offer up a place of safe retreat for those afloat, the shipwrecked and desperate, the storm-tossed boater who cannot swim, the moose, a welcome shore for every needy creature seeking harbor, a sheltered cove where one will find stability and warmth, and who will, grateful, turn to face the coldest depths from which he came, as if expecting others to arrive at any time.